Air America Radio and the Interfaith Alliance Foundation present State of Belief, Religion and Radio Done Differently. Here's your host, the Reverend Welton Gaddy.
Welcome, everyone, to State of Belief. As we say goodbye to the summer of 2007, is it gone already? I'm Welton Gaddy, president of the Interfaith Alliance, and we're broadcasting this week from the Center for American Progress Studios in Washington, D.C. Today, what did a rabbi say at a conference for the Islamic Society of North America that earned him a standing ovation from attendees and criticism from some fellow Jews? We'll ask him. Also, meet the priest who helped answer some questions about the New Testament and suddenly found himself behind the scenes of a hit play. Plus, how do Muslim student athletes face the challenges presented by Ramadan fasting? And finally, listen to this, we'll find out why a Nebraska state senator is suing God. But first, we want to acknowledge again, as we did last week, the traditional observances of many of our listeners. Muslims continue to observe Ramadan, the most venerated and blessed month of the Islamic year. And this weekend also marks the Jewish high holiday of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. The two observances don't always intersect, as Yom Kippur is timed to the Hebrew calendar and Ramadan migrates with the shorter Islamic calendar. But this year's overlap gives us a moment to reflect on the relationship between these two religious communities in our nation. Many of us can only describe the relationship between Jews and Muslims as one wrought with tension. Unfortunately, patient efforts to understand differences between us often get trumped by the easy embrace of stereotypes that further divide us. And adherence to those stereotypes is often reinforced by politics. And sadly, when religion and politics come together in stereotypes, all too often the result is violence. So it didn't go unnoticed earlier this month when a rabbi was invited to speak at the annual convention of the Islamic Society of North America. Rabbi Eric Yaffe encouraged the 1,500 in attendance to, quote, "teach us about Islam, and we will teach you about Judaism." And he laid a great deal of blame for current tensions between the two faith groups on what he defined as Islamophobia. He spoke these strong words, I'm quoting, "The time has come to put aside what the media says is wrong with Islam and hear from Muslims themselves what is right with Islam." Conference goers said the speech was galvanizing. One attendee called it excellent for the humanity of the world. But Rabbi Yaffe has been criticized by some Jewish groups like the American Jewish Committee. He's been called naive, ignorant, and superficial by some of his peers. Well, how does he respond to all of this? Rabbi Eric Yaffe is the president of the Union for Reform Judaism. The Jewish Forward identified him as the number one Jewish leader in America. This past Wednesday, I had a chance to talk with him by phone about his speech and about the reaction to it. Rabbi Eric Yaffe, welcome to State of Belief.
I'm happy to be with you.
First off, some of our listeners may not know what Reform Judaism is. Could you just enlighten us with a succinct statement about Reform Judaism?
There are three major branches of Judaism, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox. We are the liberal or progressive branch, and we believe that Reform Judaism is a developing tradition rooted in biblical and rabbinic texts, but one that adapts itself to the changing mores of society at the same time, and we're particularly concerned with issues of social justice and applying the insights of our tradition to the problems of today.
Well, you've got the elevator speech right down pat. That's good.
Right.
What made you deliver this speech to the Islamic Society of North America?
Well, it was really a prior question. I mean, we came to the conclusion that we had to talk to Muslims. The Jews had to find a way to talk to Muslims because we don't know anything about them, and in many cases, they don't know anything about us. Mm-hmm. And so we looked for a partner. We found a partner in the Islamic Society of North America, and out of that relationship came the invitation to me to address their group.
I see. What is your reaction to the critics of this speech?
Well, I don't take the criticism terribly seriously because in most instances, I don't think it's been overly thoughtful. The people who have offered this criticism in some cases, I suspect, aren't, you know, terribly comfortable with Muslims or dialogue with Muslims, although in many instances they deny that's their motivation. Some of the critics have suggested that ISNA, the umbrella group that we are dealing with, is an inappropriate group to enter into a dialogue with, and have suggested all kinds of, you know, possible ties to terrorism and so on. But in making the decision, we had very clear criteria. That is, we would dialogue with a group that, first of all, rejected terrorism, and second of all, that recognized the State of Israel and supported a two-state solution. And ISNA has accepted those two conditions, has done so unequivocally. And while it's a large umbrella group with all kinds of elements, and there's certainly, you know, those with whom we disagree and some with whom we disagree very strongly, the fact that they accepted these fundamental principles as the foundation for our dialogue, that was enough for us.
Let me pick up on one of the points that you just mentioned. Did it bother you that the Islamic Society of North America is involved in a Texas investigation where a charity is believed to have funneled funds to Palestinian terrorists?
Well, the nature of that involvement is clearly something, you know, that we looked at, and it was something that initially was troubling to us because we didn't know exactly what it meant. They were an unindicted co-conspirator, as were 300 other organizations. And apparently that term, it's not a precise term. It could mean one of many things in a legal context. I'm not, you know, not a lawyer. What ultimately was most important to us is that our government, the Bush administration, which certainly cannot be accused of being soft on terror or soft on religious extremism or Islamic extremism, they were present in full force. Deputy Secretary of Defense spoke at the same session that I spoke at. The FBI, military recruiters, the Justice Department were all represented there. This is the same Justice Department that brought that case. So our feeling was if our government, which has been so outspoken on this issue, could be represented there in full force, that clearly it was all right for us to be there as well.
I know that you talked a good bit about the importance of Islamophobia in deepening the divides. Do you worry at all about anti-Semitism in the Muslim communities, phobia related to Judaism?
Well, I certainly do. You know, I spoke about that in my speech. I said, you know, we need to help each other. We need to as Jews, to deal with Islamophobia, but we need the help of Muslims in dealing with anti-Semitism in the Muslim world. And specifically, we pointed to the fact that in a number of countries now, even though it's not native, anti-Semitism is not native to Islamic tradition, and, you know, in my belief, there's no question that there are some places in the world where it's a major force. And we suggested that an outcome of our dialogue, we hope, would be the strong support of ISNA in combating anti-Semitism around the world, plus in any cases where you know, it might appear here in the United States.
What do you think of the ISNA press release or statement during the conference condemning all acts of terrorism and specifically naming Hamas and Hezbollah?
Well, you know, again, we're very impressed by the leadership of ISNA at every opportunity. They went out of their way to express in the strongest and most unequivocal terms their opposition to terror, their recognition of the State of Israel, and, you know, specifically, they weren't at all reluctant to condemn, you know, as you mentioned, Hamas and the other groups that are actually active in Israel and are targeting Jews. So Well, clearly we have our differences as, you know, relates to the Middle East and the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. These were the most important points, and there was no equivocation on their part. So, you know, there's absolutely no reason for Americans and then American Jews not to be talking with a group that takes these stands.
Rabbi, let me go just quickly from the specific to the general. I am in a lot of circles today where people put down the importance of dialogue and say, oh, it's just a bunch of people talking to each other. It's not going to do any good. Say a word about how you view the importance of dialogue and the next steps that it can prompt.
Well, there's dialogue in general, and then there's the specific question of dialogue with Muslims. You know, my own view is it's especially important now. The Muslim extremism is a reality in the world. We see it in many places. Nobody in the right mind would deny it. We believe strongly that the American Muslim community is different because America is different, because we're more accepting. Americans, Muslims can be integrated here, can find their way in America, can escape most of the prejudice that they experience elsewhere. And in order to avoid the radicalization and some of the problems we see in Britain and elsewhere, it is absolutely essential that that process continue. And in order for that process to continue, that means that other religious groups have to understand Islam, you know, embrace our brothers and sisters in the Islamic tradition, and, you know, help in that process of integration. So, you know, the notion that somehow this is irrelevant, I think that's absurd. We're dealing with a relatively small group of people, 3 million or so, but those who are feeling in many cases, hostility, real potential, we can make a real difference with this population.
President of the Union for Reform Judaism, Rabbi Eric Yaffe, thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief.
Well, thank you for having me.
Still to come, we'll talk to the off-Broadway priest, and we'll find out how Muslim athletes can fast and play football at the same time. But up next, why is God named as a defendant in a lawsuit? Stay right here to find out. I'm Welton Gaddy, and you're listening to State of Belief on Air America Radio.
Hey, the religious right is wrong. State of Belief on Air America Radio. Send us an email or call us at 212-871-8280.
And now, the wisdom of conservative radio host Neil Bortz, as State of Belief presents another installment of In Their Own Words.
Muslims don't eat during the day during Ramadan. They fast during the day and eat at night. Sort of like cockroaches.
And that's In Their Own Words here on State of Belief.
This is State of Belief. I'm Welton Gaddy. I want to tell you, we debated whether or not to play that very offensive clip that you just heard. The fact is that we would do best to ignore ignorant and hateful comments from attention-starved radio hosts like Neil Bortz. But I can't help that it makes me angry when I hear something as stupid, as disrespectful, and as volatile as that comment. I wonder what Mr. Bortz calls Jews and Christians, since adherents to both of those religions also practice periods of fasting, or is he not that aware of religious traditions? Many Jews will fast this very weekend on Yom Kippur, and many Christians fast during the 40 days of Lent. A little later on the show, we'll hear from a reporter who spent some time following Muslim high school athletes. Like many other Muslims, some of these athletes fast during Ramadan. What are the implications of fasting for winning football games? You'll want to hear about this, so stay with us. My hope is that when you hear these Muslim athletes' stories of triumph on the field during a time of fasting, you'll think back to the sickening comments from Neil Bortz. Indeed, you may decide that if anybody's going to be called a cockroach, you know to whom the identity belongs, and it's not to holy people keeping a sacred fast, but maybe to, well, I'll just let you complete that sentence on your own. Now, normally, a story like this one coming out of Omaha, Nebraska, usually fits in best with our Choose the News game show. After all, it's so outlandish, you might think we're making it up. But we just can't wait for the next segment of that game. We have to share it with you right now. In a lawsuit filed last week by State Senator Ernie Chambers, the defendant is accused of making terrorist threats and engaging in harmful activities. Among the activities named in the suit are, and I'm quoting, fearsome floods, terrifying tornadoes, and devastating droughts. And the defendant named in this lawsuit is God. Yes, God. Now, before you dial the Nebraska State House to tell them there's a crazy person in their capital, and we're not arguing whether there is or whether there's not, you should know that State Senator Chambers said he filed the suit to prove a point about frivolous lawsuits. Anybody can file a lawsuit against anybody, he said, even God. Chambers' lawsuit has me thinking. We're always trying to keep religion out of politics here on State of Belief. What if we just filed a lawsuit? I can see it now. The plaintiff, State of Belief. The defendants, religion and politics. Location, the People's Court. Up next, what happens when theater and theology share the same stage? I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and this is State of Belief on Air America Radio. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio. You might not have known what you had by the music, right? I'm Welton Gaddy. This Monday night at the Public Theater in New York City, the cast and creators of the hit 2005 off-Broadway play, The Last Days of Judas Iscariot, will reunite. But they won't be there for an encore performance of the show. They're holding a reading of a new book chronicling the show's production. And the book is written by the unlikeliest member of their creative team. Jesuit priest James Martin is an associate editor at America Magazine and the author of the new book, entitled A Jesuit Off-Broadway, Center Stage with Jesus, Judas, and Life's Big Questions. It tells the story of how a priest with no experience in the theater was turned into a theological advisor for a high-profile new play. Father James Martin joins us now to tell us about this story, his story. Father Martin, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Now, why did this theater group come to you? And maybe more importantly, why did you say yes?
Well, I got a call from an actor named Sam Rockwell, who's in a new movie about Jesse James that most people would know. And he was working on a new play and had taken the role of Judas and asked if I would help him with the character. And then a couple weeks later, I got a call from the playwright who had gotten my name from a separate source. And then we started talking about the play. And then I got drawn into this wonderful creative process. And one of the reasons I said yes was just basically because it was fun. And they were two great guys. And I thought the idea of the play, which was to put Judas on trial for the betrayal of Jesus, was a great idea.
Well, now let's, for our listeners, let's set the stage, so to speak, here. You come into this environment as an outsider.
Mm-hmm.
You're working with accomplished actors and a very successful playwright. The director is Oscar winner Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't you feel intimidated or daunted by the task?
Yeah, a little bit. I was very intimidated by sort of their accomplishments. But, you know, once I got to know them, they were very welcoming and very relaxed, and I felt at home pretty quickly. But, you know, as I said, I also felt that I had something to offer them in terms of my own sort of understanding of the scriptures and the Bible and Jesus and Judas and stuff like that. But, yeah, at the beginning, I was a little in awe of them. But that sort of evaporated pretty quickly just because they were such great guys.
Well, I'm interested also in how they reacted to you. You were obviously dealing with spiritual concepts. Were those concepts foreign to these actors, or how did they respond?
The actors ran the gamut of sort of spiritualities from, you know, devout Christian to Jewish to fallen away Christian to Buddhist to sort of agnostic, atheist. And yet, you know, they were all interested in the story of Jesus of Nazareth and Judas. I think there's something naturally attractive about that story. And even if you're an agnostic or an atheist, you're interested in the character of Jesus. So that was a nice entree for even some of the actors that might have been on the fringes a little bit, you know, religious-wise.
I'm curious, had you ever done any kind of theological analysis of Broadway productions before?
None. I say in the book that what I know about the theater, or what I knew about the theater before I started, could be fit into a paper cup. I mean, I can't afford to go to the theater in New York City. You know, I've been to plays and stuff, of course, like most people. But and I knew some of these actors and their work, but I'd never spent any time around actors, which was a great revelation for me too, just to sort of see what their lives are like and how difficult they are, and also how much they have to rely on spirituality in their own professions.
I'm curious, did this experience change your perspective of theater?
Well, it did. For one thing, I didn't realize how hard they worked. There was one woman in the cast, Callie Thorne, who's on Rescue Me now and had a recurring part on ER. And she would get up at something like 5 in the morning, go to the shoot for Rescue Me, come home, walk her dog, and then go to the theater at 7:30 and put on this play where she had the very demanding role, and end up at 11 and then, you know, go home and start all over again. I talk about that in the book. And, you know, just the whole process of auditioning and putting yourself out there and rehearsals, and it's pretty grueling. So that was one of the big revelations, that they work, they work pretty hard.
Well, an interesting thing happened, as I understand it. In addition to your role as theological advisor, you also became a counselor of sorts for the playwright as he struggled to finish the show. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, he's a great guy. His name is Stephen Adley Geergis, and he's very well known in the New York theater world. And, you know, part of the book is talking about his creative process, which includes, you know, some struggles with a little bit of procrastination. And, you know, he was open enough, as were the other actors, to let me talk about some of their struggles as they wrote the play or rehearsed it. And so part of the book really is talking about the whole process. And in his case, you know, dealing with a bit of procrastination and frustration over not being able to get the thing done on time, at least when he wanted it. But in the end, he pulls through, and that's also part of the story, too.
I remember several years ago reading one of Nikos Kazantzakis' books on a passion play, and he talked in the book about what happened to the guy who played Judas.
Hmm.
I know that you also developed a bond with the actor Sam Rockwell, who was playing Judas. What was the journey like for him?
Well, initially it was just learning about Judas and trying to get a sense of what had motivated Judas to betray Jesus, because, you know, the Gospels are very contradictory about Judas's motives. In one Gospel it says it's money. In another it just says, you know, Satan entered into him, which doesn't really explain very much. So we had to really get to the bottom for Sam and for the rest of the cast of why Judas might have done this. And what we settled on was that Judas was probably trying to effect some measure of good from this, in the sense that he was probably trying to force Jesus's hand to get him to act a little bit and to sort of respond and maybe sort of bring on the revolution that a lot of people expected at the time. So that was the motivation that seemed to make the most sense to Sam, because he said, you know, I can't portray this character just as a purely evil person. I have to sort of understand him to be able to, you know, inhabit him as, you know, in a sense.
You know the theology behind what's going on there. How did you feel in watching the production? How is the stage a good medium or not a good medium for doing theology?
I think it's a great medium. I mean, you know, when you read the Gospels, you realize you're reading stories. And, you know, Jesus is all about stories. He tells parables. He tells, in a sense, little plays almost. And so this medium of what a lot of theologians call narrative theology, I think, is a natural one to communicate some really important truths. And I think one of the things about seeing something off Broadway and seeing it in kind of a sort of serio-comic way is that it shocks people, and it reminds them that these stories that can seem very sort of antiquated and boring, and, you know, we've heard them a million times, are really quite vibrant and exciting. And so one of the things the play did was to kind of reintroduce that whole saga of Jesus and Judas to basically a new audience in a new language.
Why did you feel the need to recount this whole experience in a book?
Well, you know, I do a lot of writing, and I had had such a profound experience of working with these actors and being with them and seeing how hard they worked, and really wanted to tell the story of what it was like for a group of people who I think really represent a microcosm of American spirituality, to come in contact with the story of Jesus and Judas, and what does it do to them? How does it change them? How does it influence their spirituality? And really, how does it play out in their daily lives, which I think is a question for all of us.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I have the sense that you feel you got out of this about as much as you put into it.
Oh, I got a lot. I got a lot more out of it, actually. These people are my friends now, and they actually, believe it or not, you know, inducted me into their acting company, which I thought was kind of fun and funny. It was wonderful. You know, as a priest, you're invited into people's spiritual lives and their daily lives, and, you know, in real intimate ways. And so, you know, it's always such a privilege. I know that sounds hackneyed, but I did get much more out of it than I put into it.
Well, just let me ride one of my favorite peeves for just a second, because I think I see for sure the value of you doing theological advising to a Broadway cast. I also think sometimes within the church, and I'm a person of the church as well, that we need some kind of advice from someone like you now who knows theater, letting people in the church and in other religious institutions know the value of the stage and actors and actresses for doing theology.
I totally agree. And I think in so many religious organizations, my own included, the Catholic Church, we tend to denigrate things like television and the stage and radio and movies as somehow beneath us. But, you know, really, that's the way people are engaged these days. I mean, popular culture really is American culture. And the same way that Jesus used sort of nature metaphors and everyday metaphors in his parables, we have to sort of use the stuff of popular culture in order to get the message across. And so, you know, I don't think you can kind of back off from popular culture. I think it's another place where people can find God if it's presented to them in the right way. So I'm all in favor of that.
The book is called A Jesuit Off-Broadway. Father James Martin will be joined by the actors and creators of the play this Monday night for a special reading of the book at the Public Theater in New York City. Go to stateofbelief.com for more details. Father Martin, it's really a pleasure having you with us here on State of Belief.
Thank you. It's been delightful.
Up next, in our sports report, on top of all the punishment that comes with a regular old football game, Muslim athletes deal with the physical toll of fasting. We'll find out how. I'm Welton Gaddy. This is State of Belief on Air America Radio.
At And now let's turn to the back pages. It's time for a look at pregame prayers, faith on the field, and Hail Mary passes in the State of Belief Sports Report.
A couple weeks ago on State of Belief, we heard from the president of an evangelical Christian group who uses sports to evangelize and even to convert athletes to Christianity. He told us, rather frankly, that the only athletes who possess strong character are Christian athletes. Now, I probably don't have to tell you that we don't share that same opinion on State of Belief. In fact, when we read a recent story in the Chicago Tribune about Muslim student athletes during Ramadan, we were hard-pressed to think of a stronger display of character. Tribune religion reporter Manya Brashear profiled some students at Stagg High School in the Chicago suburbs. The Muslim football players are eyeing the playoffs and at the same time fasting from dawn to dusk in observance of the holiest month in the Islamic calendar. Manya Brashear joins us now from Chicago to tell us about these amazing athletes. Manya, welcome to State of Belief.
Thank you.
Did these students adhere strictly to the fast, no consumption of any food or drink?
That's right. They abstain from food and drink. They also abstain from foul language, which one football player, actually both football players that I wrote about told me is a greater challenge for them on the football field is to keep a clean mouth.
Well, how did they keep from dehydrating?
Well, they actually, they both guzzle a lot of water in the morning. Part of the Ramadan fast is you rise before dawn, before sunrise, and you eat, many families eat a light breakfast. For them, that is a lot of protein and, but first and foremost, a lot of water. They guzzle a lot of water. That lasts them throughout the day, and then when the sun sets in the evening, they do it again and just rehydrate.
Well, in addition to fasting, Muslims are supposed to abstain from anger during Ramadan. Now, I played a little football, and when someone puts their hand inside your face mask on the helmet and strikes you across the nose, anger is pretty difficult not to happen. Is it possible in a sport like this, fueled by aggression, to not have anger?
Yes. In fact, that was the challenge that the players talked about. And they said that, they did admit sometimes a word or two might slip out and when it comes to foul language. But in terms of, keeping a good positive attitude on the field, I mean, these guys, they're playing on the high school level. It's really, expected. Collegiality on the field is expected of them. And these guys didn't have a problem, keeping that in mind. And especially, it being the Islamic holy month of Ramadan, they actually paid special attention to that mandate. And it actually makes them, they say, better people on the field.
How did you find these Muslim athletes regarded by their coaches and by their non-Muslim teammates?
Really highly regarded. I spoke to the football coach, Tim McAlpin, there at Stagg High School, and he said, this is not a first for him. He's had Muslim athletes on his team in years past. And they have, he said that he has in the past pointed to them, when they've taken prayer breaks, when they've gone to the sidelines to say one of their five daily prayers, he's actually pointed them out to his team and said, now that's dedication, that is devotion, and that's what we preach here in the football program, and you should follow their example.
So you would, from what you saw, religion in that setting is not divisive.
Not at all. Not at all. I mean, clearly these teenagers don't know everything there is to know about Islam. So when their teammates, go to the sidelines to pray or, don't take part in the water breaks during practice and during the games, they certainly, start to ask questions. But, most of the time they're friendly questions. The players told me, many of them ask, how do you do it? Why do you do it? And that gives them a chance to share their faith. Of course, being teenagers, they also make catty remarks, remarks that the Muslim players don't necessarily appreciate. And they are quick to set them straight and are quick to tell them, hey, they joke about them being a terrorist. They say, that's not funny, and this is my faith you're talking about. And it's, quickly quelled.
I'm curious, did any non-Muslims on the football team try fasting in solidarity with the Muslim students?
It is unclear if that's going to happen this year, but one player did tell me that he had a good friend who was Catholic 1 year and offered to fast with him in solidarity. And he lasted half a day and gave up. So it was definitely a challenge.
Is it true that some of these students believe the fasting actually helps their performance?
Some do. These players, they didn't see a difference in their performance. You know, some believe that, or I should say all faithful Muslims believe that during the month of Ramadan, you know, there are special blessings bestowed. And some, you know, believe that they actually do play and perform better when they are, you know, focusing on God and focusing on being better people in general. These players, I asked them that, and they didn't want to, you know, these are good guys. They did not want to say, oh, yes, I, as an individual, perform better on the football field, you know, during Ramadan. They are they're team players, and they immediately said, it's not about us, it's about the team. However, one did joke, you know, but it would be nice to get, you know, an extra touchdown or something from God. That'd be a nice little gift.
So when you walked away, what'd you feel?
You know, I'm always moved by these stories. I'm always moved by especially young people who are embracing their faith and practicing it. And also, it's hard being a teenager. And it was really impressive that these guys were able to practice their faith, be faithful Muslims, but also, you know, deal with the general stresses of being a teen and being a teen athlete. I'm always very moved by that.
It's a very fascinating story. We have a link to Manya Brashear's article from the Chicago Tribune. Go to stateofbelief.com. You can read it there. Manya, thanks for sharing this interesting story with us here on State of Belief.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, that's our show for this week. Let us know what's on your mind by going to stateofbelief.com and sending us an email. Or call us, 212-871-8280. That's 212-871-8280. We'd love to hear from you. And if you like what you heard on this show, why don't you think about becoming a member of the Interfaith Alliance? Go to interfaithalliance.org to learn more. Until next week, you all take care of each other. I'm Reverend Welton Gaddy, and that's State of Belief.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along.
State of Belief, religion and radio done differently.